You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Kurt Mills and Andrew Day of the American Conservative. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I can't complain. Let me introduce myself I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. And you guys are from the American Conservative Magazine. Kurt is the executive director, I think is the title, but I believe that's tantamount to being El Jefe Absoluto, right? You're the editor-in-chief?
Absoluto, but El Jefe.
Okay, El Jefe. That's enough. Andrew is the senior editor, and you both also have been known, especially Andrew, I guess, to show up on the Tack Right Now podcast. That's your podcast. And this is a joint production of the Non-Zero Podcast and the Tack Right Now Podcast. It's a crossover thing we do every once in a while to demonstrate.
We're balancing out your left-wing collabs.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's the job somebody's got to do. No, we're actually highlighting the larger than you might think intersection on the Venn diagram between somebody left of center like me and somebody on the far, 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 far right like you guys.
Mm-hmm. That's a nicer way to put it, until the very end. Yeah, yeah. I like the Venn diagram metaphor.
No, there is some overlap on foreign policy, I gotta say. Mm-hmm. You know, restrainers have a lot in common, left, right, and center. And
although we're putting ourselves at risk, Bob, because recently you came out with the piece saying that you hope Iran wins the war. So we're exposed right now politically, well, reputationally.
I carefully qualified that. It's true that I titled the piece.
Not in the headline, man. Why Iran should win.
That was not it. It was why Americans should root for Iran.
That might be worse.
Well, no, but I'm trying to signal that it's actually in America's interest for the post-war vision of Iran as opposed to the post-war vision of Israel and America to prevail, because Iran wants stability in the Middle East.
Right.
They need it. And that's actually something they share with the Gulf states.
Are you going to man the Hormuz toll booth yourself?
I am personally ready to Rambo up and just go the hell over there. Because I don't think there's enough testosterone in American foreign policy, frankly.
No.
So, anyway.
It's funny how much people freak out when you say something like Iran is the country that wants stability in the Middle East. It's like Neanderthal thinking where everyone wants all of the good qualities to be on one side, all of the bad qualities to be on the other. So people have trouble understanding that you can be opposed to the theocracy or the theocratic elements of Iran's regime and still have a different perspective on their like external foreign policy and what they're pursuing on the world stage.
It's like if bin Laden ran an entire country. That's all you need to know. And never mind where bin Laden found a constituency or how that came to be. Don't ask.
Yeah. No, I'm sure there are actually a lot of differences between the way I think about Iran and the way you guys do. But I think we all agree this war wasn't a great idea.
Catastrophe.
And, yeah, I guess. I mean, this week, I want to eventually get around to the implications for MAGA. Because that's a very interesting question that you guys are in the middle of. And I know you had Joe Kent on your podcast. I want to talk about that. You know, he's the guy who quit as head of the Counterterrorism Center in protest against the war. But I'm feeling right now, this week, like we really are at a crossroads. And I'm feeling a little more hopeful today than yesterday. We should say we're taping this late in the day, Tuesday. It'll probably go up Wednesday. Yesterday I was feeling like this is, you know, we've got one more chance for an off ramp before things could get super ugly. And I don't think Trump is going to take it. And now I kind of feel the same way, except I think maybe conceivably Trump might take it. I can explain why I'm a little more hopeful today. But what are you guys feeling?
Sure. Yeah, I'm not very hopeful. I'm not high conviction on my lack of hope, I guess. My basic cut is this all seems pretty fake. The two parties are far apart. In order to end the war, the U.S. either should go home, which I think is not the worst idea, just leave and maybe the world community will clean up our mess. Or we come to a detente with Iran, which will involve not only a deal effectively that they turned down in February, but probably a substantially more attractive deal to the Iranians, like substantial sanction relief, guarantees that we won't do this again, guarantees that we'll restrain Israel. All of that feels extremely far-fetched, frankly, because we didn't sign that deal in February, and we didn't sign that deal in February because we are constitutionally, metaphysically incapable of saying no to the Israeli government. And until that happens, I don't really know what functionally changes. I suppose I can't rule out that we retreat for 2 weeks or 2 months and then we do this again. But the essential story is we are doing this for Israel. I don't really think it's more nuanced than that. The government declared that 36 hours or so after hostilities began in early March and then backtracked. I just don't really see any reason why this will change unless Trump just has a complete change of heart and then drives policy in that direction, which has happened before. I mean, it happened on Greenland. It's happened on Russia-Ukraine negotiations. But what's different is that there's not this massive lobby on either of those theaters like this one. I don't know. Andrew, are you more optimistic?
No, I'm not. I mean, I agree with what you just said. I actually, to plug my most recent piece, I wrote a piece called To End the Iran War, Trump Must Divorce Israel. And I want to say that's not a way of absolving Trump of responsibility. When you say that the president launched a war for another country, that's actually quite the condemnation of the president, because the president is not supposed to do that. But I definitely agree that Israel was central to the determination to go to war, although it's a thing that, you know, President Trump is responsible for. As far as, you know, my level of hope and optimism now, I mean, it's not great. It sounds like you're more optimistic than I am, Bob, or more hopeful. And one, you know, I was very willing to confidently predict that the war would happen, you know, beforehand, but I'm less willing to make confident predictions now, because once you start a war, you lose control. I mean, that's part of the problem here is Trump rolled the dice. It was a crapshoot. He clearly thought that he could do decisive strikes. Apparently, we were telling Turkey and Gulf Arab allies, or partners rather, that this was going to last for 4 days. Right. And now he's in the escalation trap, which is a term that everyone's been using lately, associated with the professor from UChicago, Bob Pape. And I think that that's the right model. And as everyone is emphasizing, Iran gets a vote as to when this ends. And I agree with Kurt that it seems like Iran won't end the war until they're confident that it won't resume, which means they're going to impose costs sufficient to ensure that the world does not want to do this again, does not want the U.S. and Israel to do this again. But also they want sanctions relief. That's going to be politically difficult in the U.S. They want reparations. That seems like a non-starter unless we kind of conjoin that with sanctions, which is already politically difficult. They want security guarantees. You know, so we're hearing some of the things that we've been hearing in the Russia-Ukraine war, and it's hard to imagine what we could give them to satisfy those demands.
Israel, right? I mean, I think these people don't. These people look at the Lebanon model. They don't want to live 20 years underground only to lose, right? I mean, that's right. That's what Nasrallah did in Hezbollah. And so, yeah, I mean, you need to create a post-bellum that is more attractive than the bellum. And right now, the bellum is atrocious for the Iranians, but it's more durable than the constant threat of regime change in peacetime, I think.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, no, Iran, the Iranian vision is actually of a peaceful future in the Middle East, because they don't fare well during wars, as you may have noticed, and it's going to be a long time before things are different. So they want peace, and that was the basis for my aforementioned piece, Why Americans Should Root for Iran, which is available at the Non-Zero newsletter. But let me tell you why I'm not optimistic now. I'm just less pessimistic than yesterday. So yesterday my thinking was, you know, the trouble with Trump is he doesn't think very far down the road, right? His basic approach to life seems to be fuck around, find out. You know, you start out by saying, hey, screw you, a zillion percent tariffs. And if it works, you just step it up. And if it doesn't work, you recalibrate. And eventually China says, wait a second, we'll cut off the rare earth minerals, so you have to retreat. Whereas if you thought about, if you had gamed it out in advance, you'd know that if you keep pushing them, they will get to the rare earth. They will bring up that subject. But Trump, he doesn't look far down the road. And that was why I was so pessimistic yesterday. And, you know, and again, I'm not optimistic now, but I was just thinking, like, Trump is like, so right now, he, you know, this is what I was thinking yesterday. He's thinking, which is more politically painful, to just cut my losses and quit now, or persist in the hopes that somehow I can pull out something I can really credibly call a victory? Well, right now, it's a political loser if you quit now, I got to say. And so I would think Trump's nature is to persist.
Still better than doing this more, though. I mean, like,
oh, yeah. No, I agree. I was hoping that he would see the light. But the problem is, I don't imagine him really gaming it out and seeing how unlikely it is that persisting leads to something better.
Well, I've taken more of a, it's mocked on the right, but I've taken a more like Scaramucci or Michael Wolff lens on like understanding the guy, I would say, in recent years, you know, despite my support for him. And so, like, I mean, look at where Trump has really been up against the wall crisis wise, either events or other figures have come in and like solved the problem for him. Right. So I would say that the two major darkest hours, so to speak, of the Trump career are the early 90s and the divorce and massive series of bankruptcies. And basically a series of banks bailed him out, and, you know, his divorce was managed and he became a bachelor, which is now, of course, attracting attention with the Epstein files. And then secondarily, COVID, where the American people threw him out and sent him back to Mar-a-Lago. So like there's not like an enormous precedent for like how this would be handled like so early into a presidential term and as commander in chief of the United States Armed Forces. But it strikes me as not implausible, like the way he's talking today. And so maybe I'm just arguing as myself, which is like, go get your own oil, Britain, go get your own oil, Europe. And he just leaves and then the world figures it out. And maybe that's not the worst case scenario for the United States, for the world, for his political project, frankly.
I think it's not. I mean, what cheered me up slightly is when we got the reports, I guess maybe last night, that he was starting to tell people he might end the war without reopening the Strait of Hormuz. Gosh. Because the only way to open it, unless the regime suddenly collapses or something, and that probably leads to a situation in most ways worse than what we've got. But barring that, you don't reopen the Strait without major boots on the ground, because it's so easy for Iran from various parts of the country, not just the shoreline, to disrupt to imperil tankers traveling there. So, you know, I thought if he's really determined, if he's really decided this that it's politically unacceptable not to reopen the Strait, we're toast. But then he said, then you start hearing these reports, he is open to just cutting his losses, maybe not reopening the Strait. And then you got these reports today. Well, China, along with Pakistan, came out with these 5 points that they said could, you know, guide an end to the hostilities. For reasons I'll get into, I think they're kind of a little promising. It's been reported that they include the reopening of the Strait. That's wrong. Look at the actual statement. They are very clearly not making that a prerequisite for the cessation of hostilities. They are saying a goal would be to, as soon as possible, restore normalcy to the Strait of Hormuz or something. And that's important because Iran is not going to reopen it to its former condition for the sake of a mere ceasefire, I think. And because it's the big lever they've got. And as we've said, they don't want to sign on to any permanent kind of ending of the hostilities, for sure. That doesn't give them reasonable confidence that they're not going to get their lawn mowed again in 6 months by Israel or the U.S. So anyway, having China, you know, China has been mentioned as an outside power that Iran would actually trust, because the problem is Iran understandably wants a guarantee, like no more wars, okay? But they're not going to trust a piece of paper signed by Donald Trump or Benjamin Netanyahu. Why would they? And so I'm not sure exactly what China can do.
Or be willing to do. I mean, they haven't.
Because it's not going to be military. It's not going to be military.
Ukraine war. And yeah, I mean, they haven't. I think the Chinese are probably on net helping the Iranians surreptitiously, as far as I can tell. But I don't know. This is not the overwhelmingly influential patron that the Axis of Autocracies propagandist would suggest that it is. You know, and then additionally, I think, I mean, economically, on net, the Chinese have benefited from the war, basically. I mean, it's the mother load of electric vehicles. And I'm not really sure, like, I mean, this is a catastrophe. Yeah. If you believe in any kind of defense of Taiwan by the Americans. And
There's also, just to add to that thinking, there's also this element of don't interrupt your enemy when they're making a mistake. Yeah. Right. And, you know, I wouldn't say China's benefited, but in terms of relative gains and relative losses, even the energy shock is a bigger loss for America than for China. So in that sense, they do benefit.
I mean, do we not agree? I mean, this is just, we don't have to agree, but that China feels relatively more powerful today than it did on February 27th?
On balance, they probably consider it a win. It does have big, downsides. I mean, the high price of oil has some downsides to them. In a way that it doesn't for Russia. Russia's also benefited big time. There's no doubt about that. The question is, would China see upside to being the broker that steps in and not only makes things right, but then has real influence over the future shape of the Middle East and, strengthens, in some ways, elevates its profile, strengthens its relations with certain countries, you know. And the other thing is, like, I think China doesn't want a world in which influence is exerted militarily the way the U.S. is used to exerting it, you know, globally. That's not China's model for global influence. And that's, in a way, a problem because they're not going to, like, send troops to guarantee Iran's future. They're not. I don't think you'll ever see Chinese military bases in the Middle East. But I can see some upside for them. And I think it's notable they did this in concert with Pakistan. And Pakistan, I think, kind of has the blessing of the U.S. in this capacity. You know, it's one of the supposed mediators between us and Iran, to the extent that anything really is being mediated. I can't tell. But anyway, I'm not very optimistic. Don't get me wrong. But
no.
But I'm not as pessimistic as yesterday.
And it's probably worth noting that those comments weren't just offhand comments by Trump to some person on the telephone. Apparently, he's been picking up the phone when basically anyone with the Substack calls him if they have his number. But this was coordinated messaging with the White House. I mean, we heard Hegseth kind of dropping the need to open the Strait of Hormuz, and they're clearly doing blame shifting with Europe. I think it's basically a defense mechanism just to, like, point the finger at somebody else and say, oh, they should be taking care of this issue. I don't know if they actually expect them to.
Also arguing the regime is changed.
Yeah, he said we changed the regime twice. We're on the third regime.
That's great. And it gets better every time, as you may have noticed.
Just like every mind game, word game, every guy. I don't know. It's COVID-esque. It's George W. Bush-esque. It's Obama not getting his website for the healthcare program-esque. It's just, I mean, why? Like, does this work? And any, like, this, like, if your supporters are so loyal, you should just tell the truth, right? And, like,
I think it comes back to what I wrote about in that column I mentioned, which is just Trump's belief in the power of positive thinking. I don't know how much of an inner life he really has, but it's obviously not an unfamiliar, you know, piece of rhetoric from Trump. He will always portray everything he does as amazing. He'll exaggerate his accomplishments and he'll have a really optimistic view on what he can achieve. And so you have to interpret him in that way. And the regime change in rhetoric, at least the goalposts are being moved in the right direction. Like, I already accomplished that, so we don't really need to talk about that anymore.
Sort of. I agree with the power of positive thinking thing. I think it's true. But then he's also, like, he very rarely smiles. I mean, he sort of demands this of all of his subordinates as well. It's not this sort of, like, I don't know, music man.
Another weird thing about him is that he operates not according to having a theory of mind, like an understanding of how other people are responding to him or thinking about him. He just operates according to principles. And one of those principles is to, like, if someone attacks you, you hit him back 10 times harder. So Massey criticizes you for not releasing the Epstein files. Say something mean about him and his new wife and his wife who died. And he has principles like that are typically kind of mean-spirited.
He will back down. I think, people say he has great political intelligence. I don't think so. I think he has political instincts that have worked and mesh very well with the moment he walked into in American history. But I think basically it's just the instincts of a bully. You know, it really is. I think it's been working for him ever since the playground in junior high. He was a big, physically big guy. And it's like you talk tough and you push people around. And if they push back, you size them up and see whether, you know, they can really deliver. And if they can, you have to back off a little. And I think his MO is almost that simple.
The worry, though, is that he has stumbled into a situation in which bullying and braggadocio can't get him out of it, you know, because Iran is taking this very seriously. They're in a fight for their lives. For them, this is existential. And the Israel component, I think we should talk about it because it's very relevant to this problem. You know, Israel wants to mow the grass. That's clearly how they're thinking about it now. That's how Dubowitz from the Foundation for Defense of Democracies is now talking about this Iran operation. You know, he realizes, well, we didn't get the regime change that we were hoping for, so we'll just have to come back later, right? And it's very difficult for Trump to think through the situation, for his team to think through the situation, because it's such a difficult problem to solve.
Right. No, and that's why I said Americans should want Iran to basically succeed, in the sense that if you look at what America and Israel are after, or were after, like when I wrote that, at least Trump is always evolving, maybe, but it was a strategy that was going to lead to either state collapse, civil war, chaos, not good for us, if you ask me, or repeated mowing of the lawn, war after war after war. That is the U.S.-Israeli vision, to the extent that one is discernible. I mean, once the Venezuela thing didn't happen and you didn't, you know, find this magical successor, since apparently you made the mistake of killing all the would-be magical successors or
the
something.
The strikes were too successful.
They were too damn successful.
That was what Trump said in his first interview.
So anyway, I mean, yeah, it's like the American-Israeli vision is just dark. It doesn't lead anywhere good at this point. The Venezuela magic didn't happen. And if you look at where things go from here on in, it's not good unless you hope that Iran winds up with an outcome to its satisfaction. That's a peaceful future in the Middle East, okay?
I would say that the U.S. doesn't have a vision, and Israel does, and you've described it well. And that's the one that will predominate, because we have no strategy.
As much as they can get, basically. Mm-hmm.
And I'm not even sure if this is in Israel's long-term interests, honestly, but that's another question.
I mean, but they're assessing that it does.
And no, Bibi thinks it is. And also, in his political interest. It's working
country,
politically for Bibi.
This country's off the rails. Like,
you mean Israel or the U.S.?
Yeah, Israel. Israel's off the rails. Like, I don't know the details of this, but did you read about this this death penalty exception for the Palestinians thing that passed yesterday? I mean, so they're gonna execute just Palestinians, as far as I understand. So, you know, just openly. Yeah. Two-tier justice.
I mean, apparently,
the far right of the cabinet made Benjamin Netanyahu personally attend the passage of the vote. And then, you know, the person who drove it, the Ben Gavir guy, the national security advisor, whatever he's called, opens, you know, a flagon of champagne and celebrates this. I mean, look, I don't want to like delve into theology too much, but this is just like, I can't even imagine this in the United States or almost any other country, the celebration of death like this. I mean, this is, and I know he's far right, and maybe the median Israeli is not like that, but like.
Well, he's a central figure of
he's in the cabinet.
His coalition.
Ben Gavir is in the cabinet, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, like, super majorities of Israeli society support this war. And yeah, and I just think it's not going to really end until the United States can tell them no. And I don't really see how we're going to be telling them no in this administration right now.
I'll add, telling them no is also potentially a signal to Iran. If it's coupled from some real, like, divorce with Israel that is, like, quantifiable, like, we're not going to give them these weapons anymore, that could also that can open up an off-ramp, I think. But I don't have any optimism that it's going to happen. But the way that Iran would be perceived, that could be an opening
Trump
for diplomacy.
Trump is going to give them a deal that's more appeasement-like than Barack
Hussein. It's not going to happen.
JCPOA. I mean, it's just maybe. I mean, it would be. I mean, Reagan got away with, you know, taking us out of Beirut. Stranger things have happened. I think Trump could survive it politically. But it's just, you know, in the media, I think within his elite donor sphere, it would people would go crazy, you know, sanctions relief, guarantees of restraining Israel, even work if we can even restrain Israel. I'm not sure we can.
Yeah, the I mean, he's also, I want to, this prospect of ending the war without having reopened the Straits of Hormuz, I'm struck by how that seems to have freaked out the foreign policy establishment. And I think it's so kind of confused in some way. So Suzanne Maloney, in the Wall Street Journal story that I think kind of broke this, that Trump was thinking about maybe calling it quits without reopening the Strait, Suzanne Maloney of Brookings, who is, I think, married to or was to a true Iran hawk. I had always thought of her as not that extreme, but anyway.
She's pretty good. I mean, well, not the worst. Supposedly. I saw this quote.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so she called ending military operations before the Strait is open, quote, unbelievably irresponsible. She goes on to say, energy markets are inherently global. There's no possibility of insulating the U.S. from the economic damage that's already occurring and will become exponentially worse if the closure of the Strait continues. Like, let's be clear, okay? If Iran maintains control of the state and hostilities end, you're not going to still see oil at over $100. It's not like the status quo is going to persist. They are going to set up a toll gate, okay? But like right now, reportedly, they are charging $2 million. That's one report I saw per tanker or something. That comes out to about a dollar per barrel. Okay, the current war tax on oil is like $35 per barrel, okay? Iran, even this more extreme regime that it's evolved into in the wake of this attack, these are rational actors, okay? They're not gonna keep the price so high that the whole land infrastructure for transporting oil is rebuilt so it's not dependent on the Persian Gulf. The world could live with a dollar or two per barrel on oil coming out of the Persian Gulf. And ultimately, that's what this would settle into, I think. Now, would Iran also maybe use that control to punish enemies and reward friends? That's the way the world works. The U.S. uses its control of the financial system that way. And by the way, if there's one message that the U.S. and Israel have together sent over the past year or two, it's like, we want a world with no rules. We want a world where if you're strong enough to take it, you get it. Okay, Iran took the Strait of Hormuz. Can you take it back from them? No, I don't think you can at acceptable cost unless the regime collapses. And I don't think it would be ruinous for the world if they turned it into a toll gate. Now, you know me, I'm like a stickler for international law. I'd love a world in which international law prevailed. That ain't happening in no small part to the efforts of the U.S. and Israel together. And so it's not some kind of catastrophe if Iran stays in control of the Strait. And by the way, it solves some diplomatic problems. Right now, Iran is demanding like reparations, you know, like from the U.S. and Israel. Not going to happen. But they do need to rebuild their economy. And if, taking a toll on oil allows them to rebuild their economy and save face and say, well, we're calling this reparations, fine. I might also say you can imagine a world where China, helps architect something where there, you know, even the, and Iran, might it might be smart to be fine with this. Even the Gulf Arab states get a little piece of the revenue at the toll booth to rebuild their own countries after the war. Look, it's just very hard for me to see this ending well if we don't give up on the idea of restoring the Strait of Hormuz to its pre-war condition. I don't see how that happens.
I mean, it could be negotiated. But I just don't think we are capable of negotiating in American interests if we won't compete on Israelis.
That is a problem, is the sheer competence in the Trump administration.
Well, I mean, I don't think there's very many people in the administration that know anything about Iran. It's pretty obvious for the decision-making to go to war. But they've allowed people like Laura Loomer to flush them out, frankly. I think if they were willing to disentangle from Israeli interests, then they could get a deal that would reopen the Strait. I think it could even be better than Obama JCPOA still. But they said no to this. They said no to this in April of 2025. They said no to it in June of 2025. They said no to it in February of 2026. Like, what are we doing here?
Yeah. I mean, it's depressing to think about the people who were fired, who know a lot about Nate Swanson comes to mind. I don't.
Yeah.
in Iran Ukraine negotiations, now. And he's written some good stuff in Foreign Affairs. Oh, I'm cutting out. Sorry, I was getting a call. I was just talking about how Nate Swanson was at the State Department. He was working on Iran issues. He knew what he was talking about.
NSC.
Oh, he was at State too. But I think he got loomered from NSC.
is that a verb?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I don't think she knows you exist, but maybe this will change.
You might want to keep it that way.
Laura? Oh, it's kind of free advertising. People I can't get along with. So if you see her, send her my way.
Well, look, she's not without influence. So, I mean, like, that shouldn't be.
Well, here's a question, though. Maybe she will be. I mean, look, in the wake of this, if it becomes the kind of political disaster it seems poised to become, will Trump not, like, recalculate who he should be listening to in the future?
He seems incapable of it. He seems paralyzed by this. He seems absolutely asphyxiated by the lobby.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, look, Dan Kane, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was actually giving him fairly good advice, reportedly. Mm-hmm. You know, he seemed to understand, oh, they could close the Strait of Hormuz. Oh, they could ignite a regional war. And Trump was kind of saying, no, I doubt it, or our military can handle it if that comes to pass. I don't get the impression that Trump is now thinking, oh, Dan Kane was vindicated, I should listen to him. I think Trump's instinct is to look at Mark Levin, who's praising him and having people on his show who are saying, oh, this is the best thing since the Revolutionary War. That's who Trump is telling people to go listen to.
Yeah. Well, I don't really think it matters what Trump actually thinks, to be honest. I think Trump in his heart of hearts probably knows this is bad.
I did a poll on X, and about 75% of people said that they think Trump regrets the war. And
it's a little bit like, so this reminds me of, like, do you think that Trump believed the arguments that he was making about voter fraud, right? Like, and let's put aside, like, you know, like, I'm sure there's above zero instances of voter fraud in this country, but like the insane Sidney Powell, Giuliani, et cetera, the election was actually stolen by the Venezuelans or something like this. Does he actually believe this, or is he, asserting it as fact in his, you know, Norman Vincent Peale kind of way, as you allude to, Andrew?
Yeah.
And I found it always an interesting intellectual question, and I've actually gone back and forth. But I think it's kind of sort of irrelevant, honestly, what he thinks. I mean, I've used this before, but have you seen the young Pope, you know, where Jude Law plays the young American Pope, and in the first episode, he confesses on the roof of the Vatican or whatever to some friar that he doesn't believe in God, and like it doesn't really matter though. Like, he's in charge of the Roman Catholic Church and is moving the Roman Catholic Church in this like extremely right wing reactionary sort of revanchist way, and like Trump, you know, may, and people who talk to him, I mean, frankly, have told me, like, you know, he's still the same guy. He's apprehensive of this, et cetera, et cetera. But it doesn't matter in terms of like Donald Trump as president of the United States. Like, we are moving inexorably in this direction. And I don't know. I mean, it just seems like he cannot dissociate from the lobby.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, that's why I said earlier, I get the sense he doesn't actually have an inner life because he's been doing this for so long. It doesn't really make sense to talk about him in terms of what he believes, right? He just uses statements to advance his own power and interests.
And I do think though,
not to make it entirely about Trump and not to make it entirely about Israel, there was a felt sense, I would say, among some in conservative quarters and maybe some in the analytical community, whatever you want to call it, think tank land, that, like, you know, you saw this before, I think, particularly at the beginning of the Ukraine war, which is like, you know, any burst of sort of like, you know, Western chauvinistic victory, people lapse into these sort of like Fukuyamist frenzies. And like you saw that in, I'd say, spring of 2022. It's like, oh, actually, you know, everything we've learned in the 2000s doesn't matter. Putin is running a corrupt, dumb system that will, you know, you just kick down the door and the whole rotten structure will fall. You saw that continually, I would say, throughout the sort of establishment press, the ruling ideology, I was submitted to the Biden administration, was this crescendoing with Biden himself sort of like either senile or off message saying, you know, love of God, man, this guy's got to go, in Poland in late May 2022. You know, go back to, you know, actually what Fukuyama was predicting in spring of 2022 is insane stuff. And I think the same thing kind of happened with the 12-day war and with Venezuela, where a lot of people just sort of like convince themselves that it was a fashionable, voguish argument to say that, you know, actually, you know, everything we learned about like the collapse of neoliberalism, the collapse of neoconservatism, and all these problems of American primacy, all that stuff is stupid. And like, actually, we've invented the whatever machine, and we can just do whatever we want again. And I think that was a not inconsiderable ethos that, especially for a gambler like Donald Trump, who has these, I think he's pressed to make this decision for whatever reason, and get into that. I think that was helpful. I think he thought he would get away with it.
Yeah, but I will.
A lot of people in the church thought they would get away with it too. Where else they were? Where else they would have more vociferously objected?
Well, it's apparently my job to inject what hope I can muster into this conversation. Yeah. So I will say, it's true that, you know, he hasn't let a lot of daylight show up between him and Netanyahu. On the other hand, so far that had not cost him politically in a big way. And you know, going back to the first term, he killed Soleimani, seemed to work fine politically. I didn't think it was a good idea. He got out of the JCPOA. No great political price. It works fine. In June of this year, he kind of comes off looking as a, like a peacemaker by bombing Iran because it was kind of a punctuation mark for the Israeli attack, and it basically brought it to an end. Works fine. I think we now may be looking at a case where, and this gets back to what Trump's inner life is like, and it beats me, man. I'm open to wild hypotheses about what it is actually like to be Donald Trump. But if this becomes a huge political setback, and look, if somebody will show him the Real Clear Politics aggregate of his favorability rating since this war started, that might start getting his attention.
I don't know.
Let me just say, it would be the first time that siding with Israel really blew up politically. And since there's no precedent for that, we don't know. Maybe he would rethink. I don't know.
I mean, like his sons are posting that they've renamed the Palm Beach Airport after him. They're posting digital renderings of his library in Miami. If the Israelis and the Emiratis and the Saudis aren't going to cancel him for this war, depending on what you believe about the reporting, he can build golf courses and do all that stuff. And I don't know, maybe the Democrats will try to imprison him again and he'll flee or.
But like, I do think the worst case scenario here.
Rely on his supporters and like, and then he'll eventually die. And
yeah, I mean, it could be that he's an old dog and you can't teach an old dog new tricks. But to Bob's point, you know, this situation, if we don't find an off ramp soon, is heading for a scenario that even Trump can't ignore just by having Caroline Leavitt show in polls that 100% of MAGA supporters support him, which is very stupid because clearly when a pollster asks if you're MAGA identified, respondents just hear that as, do you support Trump? But if we get to a situation where like the Arab Gulf states are being depopulated because their desalination plants have been blown up. Mm-hmm. You know, if we're in a global economic recession with stagflation and an oil crisis and, in, you know, inflation across the board in America and his poll numbers are down to like 30% or thereabouts or below, at some point, surely even he can't ignore it. I mean, he must on some level be a canny politician just because he won the White House twice despite going up against very strong factions of the establishment.
Yeah, but the constraints on him, must be extreme. That's why he did this war. He didn't believe it. Well,
okay, but what do you think those constraints are? I mean, look, I think he is responsive to donors and this and that. And he's obviously got donors who are very pro-Israel. I understand that. I mean, you think there's actually blackmail or something going on?
Something like this, or like he's afraid of them. Yeah.
He thinks they're going to kill him, or what's he afraid of?
I think he thinks it's possible.
Well, I mean, again, for me, the test would be if siding with Israel really blows up politically in a big way, which this may well, and he doesn't adapt in a politically intelligent way, that would be interesting. But
he's a lame duck. I mean, what does he care?
The other thing. Like, does he care about the midterms? Because if he doesn't end this war very soon, the economic consequences are still going to be in play in the midterms.
Honestly, I mean, like, are they really going to assemble 68 senators or remove him from office? Like, it feels sort of unbelievable.
Well, although the co-founder of your magazine was talking about the 25th Amendment last week, right? That's how weird things have gotten.
I think his cabinet removing him is less likely than the Senate. Let me put it that way.
No, but it's interesting that Scott McConnell brought that up. We saw.
Scott Luber saw.
Scott speaks for Scott, and it was vintage Scott.
That's my kind of tweet.
Glorious. It was glorious, but it,
that's
it,
my
it
kind of tweet. You know, if you can't tweet support Iran in this war, the next best thing is 25th Amendment. You know.
Well, I mean, I would prefer Vance as the president.
Yeah, let's talk MAGA, because I have a couple of questions. One is it's hard to say because of the polling issue you raised, Andrew. I don't, maybe because of that quirk where if you say, are you MAGA, that is tantamount to saying, do you support this war? And it just, you know, it, so it biases the rest of the inquiry. But it's not clear to me yet that what dissent there is within MAGA has gone very far beyond the elite level.
And it's clear to me.
Is it? So it's like you guys and Tucker and who else is, by the way, is Bannon, is he clear on this issue? Is he?
Not clear enough in my opinion, but I think Kurt might pay attention to him more than I do. Bannon seems to be articulating a perspective that the only way out is through. We shouldn't have done this, but now we have to win or something.
I don't know. I think he wants to represent. It is what he says. I think he wants to represent a broad church on his show. I think if he was president of the United States, this wouldn't have happened. But that's a counterfactual that I can't prove.
You mean Bannon or Vance?
Bannon. But Vance.
No, I don't think it would have happened if Vance.
Trump is uniquely pressured. But both of these guys, I think the entire generation of GOP politicians thought they could work with Israel, and like this wasn't a problem. I've been harder on this than probably most conservative intellectuals, whatever you want to call it. I think you cannot do business in this country, frankly. They are not just like a casual junior partner in a coalition that will ask for like some sanctions here, you know, some investigations of Harvard there. They are asking for everything. This is all this administration is doing. This is all they are doing. It is all anyone is paying attention to. It is 95% of the political capital. It is what they're going to be remembered for. It is not actually for immigration.
We were very early on this too. I mean, even when the guy from Colombia, what was his name, Mahmoud Khalil, was being deported, a lot of immigration hardliners were saying, oh, this is a good thing. This is what we wanted. And we were saying, no, this is not what we wanted.
Yeah, the only immigrants that they deported with any like real zeal and precision were the Palestinian protesters. Yeah, they tortured people with Alcatraz against that, by the way. But like, I mean, it's like, there actually hasn't been a full across-the-board administration effort to do mass deportations. Yes, there's people deported in Southern California, but the deportations numbers, as flagged by Hillary Clinton, are basically comparable to Obama II and Clinton.
Can I say, Bob, to your point about whether this is breaking through with MAGA, the criticisms of Iran, if you go look at polling from before the Iraq war, like a month before, when, you know, back then the George W. Bush administration was actually preparing the public for a big war, which was a difference relative to this time. Mm-hmm. Republicans and Republican-leaning voters were as supportive of going to war as MAGA is now, right? And if you look at Trump 2024 voters, about a quarter of them don't support the war. Independents are totally opposed. All of these podcasts, we were told, as Kurt has said before, that that was the podcast of Bro Election 2024. They're turning on him. Young men don't like Trump anymore, and they used to like him. I definitely think that this is breaking through. It's not just an elite phenomenon, because especially if you consider the slim margins of Republican victories. I mean, Trump in 2024 won the popular vote by a smaller percentage than Hillary Clinton did in 2016. He didn't quite crack 50%, actually. So he didn't get a majority. So when you think of MAGA not as people who say I'm MAGA, which is only about 15% of the population, obviously they're not the only ones who are part of his coalition. If you instead think of MAGA as a coalition that hopefully can win, you know, if you support MAGA, or as a project, I think this is devastating. And especially when you consider, you know, it's become a personality cult and Trump won't be on the ballot again, at least, you know, we think. So the question is, can MAGA go beyond Trump, right? And I think if you look at it in this perspective, as a coalition, as something not quite the same as a Trump personality cult, as something involving all these different voters, including a lot of independents, I think it's clearly been a disaster politically.
Scaramucci thinks this is what he wants, that they lose, that the message will be that the Republicans need Trump, that they were nothing without him.
Wouldn't shock me.
I mean, I think this, look, I don't really like Scaramucci's politics, but like, I think his personal readings on Trump are interesting.
Hopefully he doesn't think about the world in the same way. I mean, I'm worried about nuclear use, for example.
I actually do. I mean, look, maybe I'm wrong. I actually do think maybe the cabinet would intervene in that scenario. And I do think in terms of using a nuclear weapon, the Israelis are more likely to do it than us.
The other thing I'd say, kind of the good news, is, you know, when you say Trump wants to be remembered as the guy without whom the Republican Party was hopeless, right? That's what you just said with Scaramucci.
It's an interesting idea. I'm not fully...
Yeah, no, but I'm saying that's kind of a legacy play. So he's kind of thinking, how will I be remembered? And I don't think he wants to be remembered as a guy who used a nuclear weapon. And I honestly don't think
Some people think he does. Some people think that he does. And there's the counter cut, which is like the sort of Yeltsin-Putin cut, which is like the level of venality. He needs a Republican successor. But like, But I think he thinks...
Well, but the Supreme Court, well, I guess they didn't insulate him against everything.
The thing that is astonishing here is, you know, I think our magazine and whatever you want to call it, the new right, people younger than 40 who, you know, were intellectually curious and optimistic about Trump, probably wanted an administration that was going to do a lot and have a lot of energy and really change the country. But if I'm being honest, the sort of like rationale for him was actually to just like do very little and like cut taxes and be popular vaguely. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of amazing he didn't do it, right? The man almost spent the rest of his life in prison. You know, they almost bankrupted everything. They would have ruined him if Harris.
It's amazing he didn't build the wall the first term. He had control of both houses.
The wall doesn't affect him. The wall, I mean, in theory, if you could just wave the wand and do the wall, maybe it would be good for him. But
he could have. He could have that first term.
I think a new Democratic president is going to try to put him in jail again, and it's this awful cycle.
Yeah. No, I'm just making the point. His attention span is hopeless. I just think he gets up every day and says, "How can I get my name in the headlines?" And if that's your approach,
What Scaramucci thinks.
What's that?
That's also what Scaramucci thinks. He says that.
I think it's manifestly true. And that's why when people say, "Well, I think the grand geopolitical strategy behind Trump bombing Iran," it's like, come on, start that sentence the right way. I mean, what is the headline strategy? I mean, and maybe the legacy strategy. I do think he tells himself a legacy story that is compatible with some way of staying in the headlines, you know? But.
Well, he was talking a lot about getting into heaven and relatedly, I guess.
In heaven.
He put that. Good for him. He said that. I don't think I'm getting in the other day. I thought that was actually the best thing he said all year.
Yeah. And the Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, there is a strong interest in legacy.
He got the FIFA Peace Prize, and that's the next, the next best thing.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. No, I forgot that. I don't know why I don't.
He also got the first annual.
Do you have a FIFA Peace Prize? No.
I forgot the FIFA Peace Prize. I regret.
You're a true American, Bob. You call it FIFA.
Oh, man. These games, involve baseball bats. Well,
I'm a little skeptical. Well, hold on. Andrew, do you want to? You have a favorite pet project is going after this person who works for the Hudson Institute who produces schizophrenic ramblings, justifying that is great for Israel that Trump is doing. Like, how would you describe this metaphysically? What this is like? It's like something horrible happens. Like we enter this massive war that nobody wants, and then it's like, oh well, the real winner here is Japan, and Japan is behind it.
Insane.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just
people eat it up.
Yeah. Well, I think in her case, and I forget her name.
Something I've met her once. She's look, maybe we always knew this about the Hudson Institute, but this is just like, this is
It's incredible that this person has a job at a think tank. I mean, it's totally ridiculous. She seems like a robot gone awry or something, and all of her comments on Twitter, at least, are totally insane. But yeah, a lot of people clearly are kind of looking for a geopolitical rationale to everything Trump does. And so they talk about this in terms of China. I think that one perspective that has emerged among people who call themselves conservative realists, and I was reporting on this a little bit after the Venezuela raid, because there was a bit of a divide between conservative realists and conservative restrainers. And the realists were starting to think, okay, we promised that we won't pursue wars that are not in American interests. So now whenever Trump does a war, we tell a story about how it's in the American interest, right? Mm-hmm. And usually that involves how we're vanquishing all of our enemies to set up some kind of confrontation or competition with China. And I think you can tell that story somewhat about Venezuela, although I wouldn't agree with the story, but it would make more sense. But in the case of Iran, it makes no sense because, I mean, first of all, geopolitically, the U.S. intervenes according to realism to prevent a regional hegemon from arising. Whereas in this case, Israel is the regional hegemon and we are creating their regional domination of a region of extreme economic importance to the global economy. And also, we're just burning through our munitions. Our democratic or diplomatic credibility is totally shot. It's not clear how we're going to actually like negotiate with countries on difficult issues if they think that we're doing so as a ruse to kill their leaders.
Right.
And China clearly looks like the responsible actor. And they are, by comparison. It's not just a perception, the responsible actor on the world stage.
Yeah, there was a funny moment on the All In podcast a couple of weeks ago. They were, you know, I mean, that podcast, you know, I still listen sometimes, but it's just become Pravda for Trump. It's pathetic. And they were talking about, it was after the war had started, and Chamath and somebody else is going, there's this master strategy involving China behind this. And the guest that week was this guy who's number two at the Pentagon, used to work at Uber. Is it Emil something or whatever? You know,
Michael.
And he basically signaled without quite saying so, like, you guys are full of shit. You know what I mean? He just didn't buy into it. He just didn't. He very pointedly.
The guys at the Pentagon are the best ones.
Really? That's what it seems like to me. Our Secretary of War?
Including Pete?
Except for him. Everyone below him.
That is the best of the Iran hawks, though. I think he is the
purist form.
Yeah, this is what it is.
Remember.
Rubio intellectualizing. It's just murder, shut up. And like, no, I think it's extremely powerful.
Remember when he was nominated, you know, the part of his dark past that dominated the headlines was the sexual assault case, which was actually complicated and it was hard to say what happened. But there was a more clearly documented thing where at the time, one of his colleagues filed a written report saying Hegseth got drunk and started screaming, kill all Muslims. Okay. Hmm. That was like attested to at the time. So naturally you put him in charge of a war against a majority Muslim country.
He's a Christian Zionist. He's like an insane committed Christian Zionist who wants to like rebuild the third temple.
Who among us hasn't gotten extremely drunk and started screaming about Muslims? I mean, this is, this is just a gear we all have.
Well, I don't drink, but I'm sure if I did, it would happen. No, I wouldn't. But yeah, by the way, there's a local travesty I'd like to report from Princeton, New Jersey. The Nassau Inn, this old, you know, hotel right just next to the university. It must be hundreds of years old.
Okay.
The Yankee Doodle Tap Room, they have like these pictures of distinguished Princeton alumni. It's got a big picture of Bill Bradley. Mm-hmm. And now below it, right below it, they put Pete Hegseth below Bill Bradley. I made sure this news reached Bill Bradley, by the way.
Oh, really?
Didn't make his day.
No, Hegseth really creeps me out. I mean, I find him very disturbing, especially when he's bringing religion into it and, you know, like quoting the Old Testament to justify raining death from the sky.
But I think he has a constituent view of like Republican power and conservative power, which is actually pretty interesting.
And he's running for president, right?
Yeah. I think so. Yeah.
That's the vibe for sure.
Like, it's like you need Fox News. It's like you need old people. It's like you need the religious right. Like it's an actual, like, I don't think I'm gonna, like, make this case for him, but like I actually think that his primary strategy is theoretically more plausible than Rubio's, legitimately.
Like, yeah.
I'm not voting for him, but like, I mean, I actually think if he can raise some money, it's not inconceivable. Mm-hmm. Like, and as
that's scary.
Especially if the administration is in the toilet, it may not be a very
be
a very attractive nomination to seek. And well, so
it partly depends on how this war goes. I mean, it may be just irretrievable from his political point of view. We'll see.
Yeah. Yeah, but someone's going to run for the nomination, and stranger things have happened.
Well, yeah,
people hate Democrats. People really hate Democrats. And I will say, like, you know, my friends in Left Restraint accepted, and a few members of Congress accepted. The Democrats have been pretty pathetic on this war. I mean, like, I mean, where's the leadership? Like, yeah. I mean, I see almost no visibility. Like, Newsom said something about Israel, then immediately backtracked. Like,
no, it's
bad. Not 05, 06. You know, this is not ruthless anti-war Democrats. It's nowhere near it. And so I'm not entirely convinced the Republicans will lose in 28. And I don't know the lesson.
Look at Kamala. I mean, when they ask her what's America's biggest enemy, didn't she say Iran or something?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think Kamala may very well be the nominee. It sounds like she's winning again.
No, I don't think so.
I think she can win. I think she can win.
She's apparently running. I mean, her mailers that she's sending out strongly suggests she is.
Kamala, it ain't happening.
What have we learned from Democratic nominating contests? You need the black vote, at least not against you. And I think she will have it in large measure for her. And I think that's a major foundation to build upon. And
I don't know. I think Chris Murphy may make a serious
man, you and Scott.
Man. Scott, who's Scott? Scott McConnell.
McConnell.
He's a Murphy guy?
That was the other part of the 25th Amendment. He wanted to install Senator Murphy as vice president in a moment of bipartisan comedy. C-O-M-I-T-Y, not comedy. I'm not. I mean, yeah. I look.
It's both, but yeah.
Brilliant. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's on offer.
And look, I guess Ro Khanna can't realistically win. But
I think Ro Khanna's the best Democrat. I've said so.
He is. I don't know foreign policy. Bernie is good, but I think even Bernie would say he's too old.
I'm fairly bullish on Khanna, but one thing that should be noted is he's got what may be the most boring stump speech I've ever heard. If you have ever seen him deliver a speech, I mean, he's good in interviews because he's smart and he's learned how to kind of package his intelligence for these like short clips and such. And maybe he has a base with like parts of Silicon Valley that are not right wing.
They're also trying to run him out. So like are they? Yeah, there's a contingent of like SF politics that want to primary him. I mean, I think he is quite obviously the best in foreign policy on the Democratic side. I don't think his chances are as bad as you. And I think our colleague Jude Russo do. But he is fundamentally an Indian American representative of Silicon Valley, at a time that Silicon Valley is divisive. And he is a backbench congressman from California at a time that Congress is unpopular. No Congress has ever elected president. California is really unpopular. It's going to be a problem for Newsom and Harris. So, like, you know, there are serious headwinds. But again, he is at least saying stuff that's good as opposed to saying nothing. We're saying things that are actively bad, which seems to be most of the Democrats, I have to say. I mean, I will say just to pimp our side, a lot of the energy is actually from the anti-war right. Like, I mean, the absolutely caustic, furious rhetoric is from our side.
Plus it is us being
humiliated. It is this administration that is being squandered. And I don't know. Stranger things have happened.
Looking at the whole political spectrum, yeah. Well, liberals, left, right, more energy is coming from you guys.
I think so. The most angry about the Iran war, I think, is the anti-war.
Well, there's real anger on the far left. You know, I also do a kind of a crossover podcast with the American Prestige guys, Derek Davis.
And
they are true leftists. You know, I'm just kind of like left of center.
I think they have a little less constituency in the Democratic Party than we probably do in the Republican. So there's that.
I think that I think that may be true. And they're also less inclined to connect this to Israel than you guys are.
Yeah. I think that's an error.
Which is interesting because they're both very critical of Israel on its own terms.
Critical
you know?
Of Israel, but the left wing explanation of U.S. foreign policy tends to involve like empire and oil.
MIC brain. It's all this stuff, but it's just not true. Like the table was set by Israel. Trump ate the meal, and the MIC is happy to profit off of it. But the causality there. I mean, Andrew, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I was just thinking it does seem to me like a test case for this dispute, you know, where lefties tend to see Israel as serving as a kind of attack dog for the U.S. empire, mm-hmm. whereas people on the right are more inclined to think that the tail is wagging the dog.
This metaphor is getting pretty complicated. is it the attack dog's tail? Or
it's out of control, Bob. It's out of control.
This is out of control.
It's a barely mixed metaphor.
Okay.
But you know what I mean. I mean, that is the difference in analysis. And to me, it does seem clear that, Trump is responsible for this decision. He is more broadly hawkish. I mean, what he did in Venezuela, his gestures on Greenland. But it seems to me that if you just look at the geopolitical interests involved, it's clear that this is for Israeli interests and not for American interests. This is bad for American interests, and this is consistent with the Israel kind of clean break memo strategy of seizing the strategic initiative and vanquishing all of their adversaries, right? And then, you know, even Trump, after the 12-day war, he told the Daily Caller, I did this for Israel. I bombed Iran for Israel. He was bragging, you know, but he's the one who said it. For all of those reasons, I think this is a case where we're kind of vindicated on our side of the debate.
Rubio said it as well.
Trump has been candid about Miriam Adelson's influence. I'm sure you saw his whole riff about she walked, comes into the Oval Office, and I say, Miriam, I already moved the embassy. I already did this. And he said, she always wants something for Israel. I say, Miriam, I did this and this and this. She always wants more. So I do.
He also insinuated she cared more about Israel than America.
Yeah.
Openly.
And his Knesset.
In his laudatory address. The counter, I'm inferring, and I don't want to, they can speak for themselves, they're very bright. I'm inferring a greater hesitancy to raise the Israel question because of the problem of anti-Semitism, which I don't, just out of hand. But like that can't overrule the truth, which was this driven by the Israel lobby.
I've had this conversation on anti-Semitism with a couple of people lately, including Ron Campius and Peter Beinart on the podcast. And something I didn't quite, maybe I kind of got around to saying it, but I think I did with Ron. The longstanding kind of speech code that has equated certain kinds of criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. And, you know, groups like AIPAC and the ADL have used this equation, the supposed equation between, for example, saying, I think this amounts to apartheid in the West Bank and being anti-Semitic or whatever. I think that the enforcement of the speech code itself has been conducive to anti-Semitism. I was saying this to Ron, for example, if you listen to the Nick Fuentes origin story, he's like saying, I just started out asking innocent questions. Now, I don't know if this is true, but I can see how it could be that you say, wait, why are we giving all this money to Israel? And Ben Shapiro says that's anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
And to me, it is so analogous to the woke speech code and the rise of the anti-woke movement, right? Yeah. It's like, we're just tired of you being so strict in your speech policing that we can't say even pretty innocuous things that are obviously true. And for most people, it ends there, right? They just go, so I'm going to support an anti-woke candidate. They don't go full on racism in reaction, but invariably, some people are going to, and I do think to some extent, the enforcement of the speech code has actually fomented anti-Semitism.
Yes.
Totally. I listened actually to this Ron Campius interview, and I did want to say something about Iraq because he was very skeptical that we can say that the Israel lobby influenced the decision to go to Iraq.
I thought you'd be proud of me for bringing up the clean break memo.
I was.
Andrew and Harris, our Berger, our correspondent, have been doing yeoman's work on the canard that Israel had nothing to do with the Iraq war.
Well, One thing is, I just want to establish the set of facts that we can all agree on. So a lot of people, they'll say that Netanyahu, he was just a private citizen when he testified to Congress that we, of course, should overthrow Saddam Hussein's regime. And if we do, there's going to be peace in the Middle East and it's going to be great for American interests. Okay, yeah, he was technically a private citizen, but first of all, he had just recently been prime minister. Actually, at the time of the invasion, he was finance minister. From late 02 to early 03, he was the foreign minister. And even in during this break between 99, when he left as prime minister, and 02, when he became foreign minister, he was an extremely involved political operator. He was the main rival of Sharon within Likud. And American neocons agreed with Netanyahu. That's kind of the first thing to note. And secondly, Sharon, Ariel Sharon, was not as opposed to the war as people make it seem. He did have a conversation in which he was telling Bush, you know, Iran is what you should hit. You should hit Iran first. They're the worst actor. And he was skeptical, I think, of democratization projects in Iraq. But he came around pretty quickly, and his government was putting all this information out there about biological and chemical weapons from Iraq. They were saying that they had transported them to Syria and they were being held there for nefarious purposes. I don't think it was the only factor, you know, the Israel lobby and Israel itself, but it clearly was one big factor. And I don't know why people can dismiss that as an anti-Semitic trope, because everything I just said is factual.
So I'm going to, I have a reply to that. I'm going to keep people completely in the dark about what it is, because I would like to, at this point, go into overtime with your indulgence. Now, we've been talking like an hour, right? But as you know, the non-zero business model rests heavily on having some paid subscribers who get, among other things, in addition to the satisfaction of knowing they're supporting a worthy cause, they get access to the overtime segments. So if we could, with your permission, I'd like to bring down the paywall. I also, in overtime, want to ask about your recent podcast, which I mentioned with Joe Kent. I have some questions about some of his answers. In some ways, I was disappointed. I thought you asked the right questions, but maybe then we can also get back into the MAGA thing. And I will say something about Israel and the Iraq War, but you're not going to get it for free, folks. So if you go, there's a link in the show notes to become a paid subscriber. You can go to nonzero.org and just click on this post and. Then if you want access to the whole thing via that, as opposed to what we've already heard, then you become a paid subscriber. Meanwhile, you should also check out the American Conservative and the aforementioned TAC Right Now podcast. That's TAC for the American Conservative. Is that supposed to be also like a recommendation we should tack right, like a direction? Mm. No?
Draw your own conclusions.
Okay. So that was a branding inspiration on my part. Sounds like I was the first person to have it. But anything else you guys want to recommend that people check out? Like your Twitter handles. Andrew, you've become just a ball of fire on Twitter. What is your handle?
AKDay89. Yeah, I've been tweeting a lot more since the Iran war started.
Yeah. Check him out before he gets deplatformed, folks, because it's getting pretty out of hand. And then, Kurt, what is your Twitter handle?
I'm at Kurt Mills, at CURTMILLS. And yeah, look, you can support the work by going to www.theamericanconservative.com. We have a print issue that comes out 6 times a year. It'll come out again early next month. If you want to see the home of conservative opposition to this war, I don't know where else it is. It's us. Thank you.
We'll ask Tucker if he agrees. If there's just no other place.
Well. I mean, far be it for us to malign Tap and Vorsky.
No, you'll be voting for Tucker in 3 years.
But no, I mean, we do a different thing. He does a podcast. Yeah. We're putting out a multiple.
Totally.
We're a good magazine. Yeah.
Totally. Okay. So now we are going into overtime.